My name is Faiza Patel. I am the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And we're here to talk to you today about a report that the program produced, which looks at the president's efforts to restructure our immigration system, both through bans on particular nationalities, but also through the more hidden process of extreme vetting. Our team, led by our fellow Harsha, who will be presenting in a minute or two, looked very carefully at all of the ways in which the United States controls entry into its borders and looked at what the president's proposals will do to that. And we would like to discuss what we found today with you. Just a couple of things. Remember, just sort of housekeeping matters. First of all, I'm instructed to tell you that we are on Facebook and Twitter, as well as at BrennanCenter.org, as well as on iTunes and YouTube. So you basically can't get away from the Brennan Center if you're on social media, but please do follow us. It means so much. Last but not least, please do turn off the volume on your cell phones. We don't want any ringers embarrassing you in the middle of the presentation. And with that, I am going to turn the floor over to Harsha. Please welcome him.
Hey, everyone. Thanks, Faiza. So President Trump has many times called for the extreme vetting of immigrants and visitors to the United States, saying that people are coming here in large numbers intending to do harm, and that we let them in without an effective screening process, with no documentation and no paperwork, as the president himself has said. That's a stated reason behind the efforts to put scrutiny on certain visa applicants and to ban travel from certain parts of the world where it's said that adequate screening can occur. But our report found that the president's claims don't hold up and that his vetting policies seem driven more by discriminatory intent. First, our visa issuance process, though it's not perfect, is already really tough. In other words, we already extremely vet people. Some of the president's new measures add to our existing system so that certain visitors are asked to submit more personal data than someone would have to submit to get a top secret security clearance, so to work at the CIA, for example. And furthermore, already visa refusal rates are high. In 2016, more than 40% of temporary applicants from 7 out of the 8 countries, and a couple of them substantially more, targeted by the newest travel restrictions, were turned away. And statistically, our vetting system's been working. Terrorist attacks carried out by foreign-born people are exceedingly rare. Foreign-born terrorists have committed less than 0.5% of all murders in the country from 1975 through the end of 2015. And nearly all those came on September 11th, after which our vetting system was completely overhauled. So that leads us to our second finding, that this administration's policies are based on prejudice, mainly against Muslims, rather than proof that extreme vetting or travel bans make us safer. I think about it this way. There are two stories that you could tell to frame these policies, and one makes a lot more sense than the other in terms of describing exactly what's going on. One story is that we have a porous visa system that lets in all sorts of harmful people who go on to commit lots of acts of terror. And so we need to fix it, and fix it immediately. But empirically, the story doesn't stand up. The second story considers that, as a federal court of appeals has said, these vetting and ban policies emerge from a context that drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. A context informed by President Trump's statements, which have in the past called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S., a clarification that the Muslim ban is something that in some form has morphed into extreme vetting. More broadly, it's a context that includes plans to cut legal immigration in half over a decade, roll back protections for undocumented young adults who were brought to the U.S. as children, increasing the arrests of undocumented people, and to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. This second story also considers the pushback to the president's initiatives from both current and former national security officials, and the administration's failure to follow normal procedures in the course of crafting them. Though the latest travel ban was apparently the result of a neutral review process, that process allowed for a lot of discretion. Without explaining why, it would largely affect the same people as its predecessor and apply the same bars on travel that experts across the political spectrum have said are damaging to our national security. And even assuming bans were good policy in these conditions, which they're not, no one from any of the targeted countries has committed a fatal terrorist attack in the United States in the 40-year period through the beginning of last year, for which data has been aggregated. And the president's policies come with costs, both economic costs and costs to our country's values. While we should always be looking for ways to better secure our visa systems and improve national security, we should be motivated by evidence, not fear, and consider the trade-offs of doing so. With that, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Ron Nixon. He's the New York Times Homeland Security correspondent. So thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Harsha. Good evening. How's everybody? Okay. Me a little louder than that. Okay. Wow. Okay. Wow. So thank you so much for turning out for the event. I am going to more or less be the guy keeping time and moving things along. These people are the panelists here, the experts in this area, and I'm actually anxious to hear what they have to say myself. As Harsha mentioned, I'm the Homeland Security correspondent for the New York Times, so I cover Department of Homeland Security, along with other agencies that deal with border security, such as the DEA and within the Justice Department. So with that, I'm going to introduce my fellow panelists, and then we will get into the meat of the discussion. To my immediate right here is Adam Cox, who is the Robert A. Kindler Professor of Law here at NYU School of Law. To his right is David Beer, who's a policy analyst at Cato Institute in Washington, and I've seen David a couple of times here and there since I'm based in Washington. Harsha, that you've met at the end there. Lena Masri, the National Litigation and Acting Civil Rights Director at the Council on American Islamic Relations. Okay, thank you. And Murad Awada, who's the Director of Political Engagement, the New York Immigration Coalition. So thank you all for to the panel, and we'll just jump right into it. So Adam, since you're to my right here, how would you describe this new vetting regime that the Trump administration wants to put in place in the context of American immigration law historically? Is it vastly different from Bush era, Obama era vetting, or how different, if there a difference, how different is it, and what does this, represent a paradigm shift, or is it something that, you know, because there were conversations about this during, right after 9/11 as well. So how different is this really?
Well, I guess I'd say that the rhetoric surrounding both extreme vetting and immigration policy more generally during the campaign by then-candidate Trump and since the election by both President Trump and by other administration officials does reflect, I think, something, a real break with recent experiences in immigration policy and national security. That said, I think there are really very long-standing historical parallels to the kinds of practices that we're seeing and the kinds of political, moral, and legal battles that have emerged as a result of those practices. So, you know, at some level, immigration law is all about extreme vetting, or at least about vetting. I mean, it inheres in the very definition of what immigration policy is. Immigration policy, fundamentally, you know, reflects rules by which the government sifts through the pool of potential migrants and chooses to admit some that the government deems desirable and worthy of admission and to exclude the rest. And any screening system like that, you know, is, as the American immigration system has over the years, is going to provoke debate and often legal disputes over both the ends that the government's trying to accomplish, you know, the fundamental question of who should be permitted to come to this country,
right,
you know, and also the means by which the government tries to accomplish those ends.
Okay.
And, you know, just to give two examples. So on the means side of things, it's really long been true that there have been anxieties about the secrecy and lack of process surrounding the vetting of migrants. So in the wake of World War II, for example, Congress passed a law to permit American servicemen serving abroad to bring their spouses, well, then it was just brides, so it was
right,
actually the War Brides Act, to the United States. But that same Congress gave the Attorney General the power to exclude immigrants without a hearing on the basis of secret evidence if the Attorney General determined that their admission would be contrary to the interests of the United States. And in a famous case, a woman married to an American serviceman in Germany came to the United States, arrived at Ellis Island, and was excluded on the basis of secret evidence without a hearing. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, that's okay.
Okay.
On the end side of things, that's, you know, the secrecy surrounding the process has been with us for a long time. With respect to the concern that the government will use superficially neutral policies to target undesirable groups, particularly immigrant groups that the government's identified on the basis of race or ethnicity or religion, that's been with us for a long time too. You know, the very first federal immigration law, exclusion law ever passed, the 1875 Page Act, it's passed during the, you know, the aftermath of the Civil War, during Reconstruction, during a period when there was rising anti-immigrant sentiment on the West Coast, centered around Chinese immigrants who'd come to California to work during the Gold Rush and during the construction of the railroad. And that act is facially neutral. You know, the first exclusion law ever adopted by the federal government says, we're going to exclude people who have criminal convictions and people who are engaged in prostitution.
Okay.
But everybody knew that the reason that law was passed was it was passed to target mostly Chinese women.
Okay. So let me stop you there, because that segues into what I want to ask next, and that is, David, what is it that this executive order is supposed to accomplish? And based on the way that it's gone through a number of iterations, right, based on the way it is now, would it be able to accomplish that? Because it does sort of lead into what Adam was talking about, setting up definition of exclusion.
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand what the travel ban is trying to accomplish on its own terms. And what the administration and the president are saying is that the reason why this travel ban is necessary is because we cannot obtain enough information about these people who are traveling to the United States from their governments in order to process their visa applications. That is at the heart of the executive order. And when you start thinking about, okay, is that true? Is it a requirement for the government to merely process a visa application to have contact with foreign governments and to obtain a lot of information from them? And the answer to that question is no. In our immigration process, you, as the visa applicant, have the burden of proof to prove your identity, to prove your eligibility for that visa. And if you can't prove that because your government is, MIA, then that hurts you. That doesn't hurt the U.S. government. So really what this ban does is it denies consular officials in countries around the world, U.S. officials, the opportunity to even review these applications. Why does it do that? It does that not because none of these people could ever prove their identity or eligibility to come to the United States. It does it because it doesn't want them to review applications of people who can prove their identity and their eligibility to come to the United States.
So just let me, could you just explain that? Because that seems a little counterintuitive.
Sure.
What do you mean by that?
So if it was the case that no one could prove their identity or their eligibility to come to the United States, we would already have a ban. And that's because you, as the applicant, must prove your identity and eligibility in order to obtain a visa. And consular officials are there to process those applications and review them and review the evidence. And if you can't provide enough evidence to support your claim, your visa application will just be denied on an individualized basis.
But let me just jump in with this. But they do have to vet that. The consular officials, they have to vet that. You know, the diplomatic
Absolutely.
Security folks, the
yeah.
ICE with their visa security system. Right?
Absolutely.
So it's not just you're providing the information. They also have to vet that information. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They review that information. They make sure that the information is valid. Mm-hmm. And if your information
your
is...
Your documents are real.
And right? your documents are real. And if your documents, you can't provide proof that your documents are real or there's some suspicion that your documents are false, then your visa application will be denied. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose of the ban is to deny applications to people who can provide that support for their claims, for their identity. As was mentioned earlier, there are very high rates of denials from these countries that are, the people who are being banned. Most of their applications, a majority of applications from Syrians are denied, right. in part because they can't prove their eligibility for a visa or their identity. So it's already the case that we have a vetting system that puts the burden of proof on the applicant to prove their claim. And the goal of this order is to prevent people who can prove their claims and their identities from being able to travel to the United States. And the government has never put forward any evidence that we cannot trust consular officials' decisions in this matter. They've never said, we don't trust consular officials. Here's why. Here's the evidence that shows that they're approving applications when they shouldn't. So that's never been put forward in any of the proclamations or administration documents. They've just tried to obfuscate what the real goal of the order is, what it's actually trying to do.
So let me stop you there, because I want to come back to you two both on the legal and historical thing of what immigration law actually is, plus how we've traditionally done this, and basically like to ask, okay, what's wrong with that? Every country vets people coming in, right? If I go to the UK, they're going to vet me, right? So we'll come back to that. Okay, but Lena, so could we talk about what's happening on the ground with this, right? The first iteration of this, there was just, it was described as chaos. And with JFK and Dulles airports and a lot of the other airports around there. But beyond that, I mean, how is this impacting particularly Muslim communities, right? Because that seems to be the heart of what we've talked about. The president has talked about this. The majority of the countries that are impacted by this ban are majority Muslim countries. But on the ground, what effect does this have or will this extreme vetting have?
Thank you. And the on-the-ground question is really what we need to be looking at. Initially, we know that the Trump administration had called for a total and complete shutdown. But as they've been embroiled in litigation and having to water down the executive order again and again and dealing with the issuance of injunctions, we need to understand that as the entire country was looking at the litigation that was going on, at the same time, there was a backdoor Muslim ban that was being implemented and that was happening at the same time. So on the one hand, we know that the number of visas that were being granted during this time period, regardless of whether there was an injunction or not in place at the time, was severely reduced. That's one. But the second thing that's important to know is that the religious questioning of Muslims at ports of entry skyrocketed. And I want to talk about this for a little bit because the Trump administration began implementing a policy where non-citizens that were trying to gain entry with a valid visa, as immigrants or non-immigrants, were being asked questions about their religious faith, their religious practices, questions like how many times a day do you pray, are you Muslim, are you Sunni, are you Shia, when did you convert to Islam, who is your religious leader, what mosque do you pray at, questions that are designed to determine the level of religiosity that you have. And make no mistake, although this appears to be a new policy, it's not a new policy. The reason why within days of the Trump administration taking office, our offices all over the country were flooded with complaints like this is because the actual practice of religious questioning had been entrenched under the Obama administration.
Let me just jump in and ask with that. That's exactly what I want to ask you. So first thing is, how do you document that this is happening? I mean, is this something that your people are calling in and telling you that this is happening? And then secondly, you just answered the question, I guess, is this new? Is this something that the Bush administration did, something that the Obama administration did? But to the first question, how would you document something like that, and how do you verify that questioning is actually happening?
So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we received a case where a family of U.S. citizens, they're all U.S. citizens, but the father, husband, is a Canadian citizen. They were stopped at the U.S.-Canada border at a port of entry in Michigan, and they were asked nothing but questions about their religious beliefs and practices. They were asked how many times a day they pray, which mosque they go to, and all of the other questions that I mentioned earlier. And ultimately, even though he's a Canadian citizen and he doesn't need a visa to enter the country, they had to let in the U.S. citizen family members, but they turned him back. They did not allow him entry, and so the wife and children, young minor children, were forced to drive to Florida on their own without the father, and he had to turn back and go back into Canada. And this is a running theme that we have been seeing since Trump took office. Now, as far as the program itself, the Obama administration did have a religious questioning program, but it primarily targeted American Muslims. American Muslims were questioned at ports of entry. Our office actually filed a lawsuit regarding this issue in 2012. And the list of questions that we were able to get through discovery are identical to the list of questions that Trump is now using to question non-citizens that are seeking entry. So it's a program that was easily adapted by Trump, and the focus was now shifted to both American citizens and non-citizens, whereas before, mm-hmm. it was targeting the American Muslim community. And just as a final note on this, and I'll give an example of a meeting that I attended back in 2012 with FBI agent special in charge of Detroit at the time, Andy Arena. And he said during that meeting that he directs his FBI agents to question the Muslim community. Why? Because the more religious they are, the more likely they are to commit terrorism. And this is something he said in front of, I don't know, 50 community leaders that were there. And it really emphasizes the national security has always been cited by the government under the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and now the Trump administration as a justification for policies that target and discriminate against the Muslim community. So what Trump is doing now, unfortunately, is nothing new. It's just explicit.
Okay. So, Murat, when you hear these types of things, and again, what's looking at this on the ground level, right? What is the effect there? I mean, are people like afraid to travel both in and out of the country? Or are people just afraid in general? I mean, what kind of sense do you, and is it because of the actual mechanism of the ban itself, or is it the fear, as some people talk about with the decline in apprehensions at the border, is that people hear about that there's no new wall there, but they just fear coming. So is it the same kind of thing here?
So I think that we tend to forget that Muslim discrimination didn't just start with Donald Trump. And I think that that's the piece to answer your question outright, is that post 9/11, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, now the Trump administration are championing national security issues as reasons why they will discriminate against Muslim Americans and Muslim immigrants alike. One thing we have noticed is that back in when NSEERS was announced in the Bush administration, that type of fear of the Muslim registry when people were going has continues. That fear never went away. Traveling in the U.S. as a Muslim, and personally as a Muslim man, the additional screenings just become part of life. Like, you are flying domestically, getting searched a couple times is not something ordinary folks go through often, but even with TSA PreCheck, it doesn't matter. So I think the community sentiment on the ground has been a very sensitive one, for the simple fact that we have been under attack in this country for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And that it's not going to go away with, you know, doing a Ramadan iftar in a White House. It's going to go away when our community feels safe in this country. And the fact of the matter is even before Donald Trump announced his first Muslim ban, 2 days before it, he signed an executive order, which technically didn't have any power, but he did it to deliver on his promise of an increased enforcement. And that, everyone tends to forget that enforcement affects all immigrants across the board. And specifically, folks who are Muslim tend to be targeted even more for detention and deportation. So while we did see an uptick in fear, we also saw an uptick of people not being able to reunite with their families here. We saw an uptick in people not wanting to travel because they might get caught at the airport if he decided at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night in his bathroom that he wanted to sign something that would ban them from coming back to the United States. He can do that. So there's a number of different reasons for the fear, and it's all justifiable. It's not like this fear is coming out of nowhere. Right here in New York City, we had the NYPD doing their own Muslim surveillance program for years. And the only reason why we found out about it, even though there was that sentiment within the community that they felt they were being spied on, was because an AP story received leaked materials from the NYPD that illustrated the depth of the domestic surveillance program that they were doing here. So the rationale is that, for the government side, is that they're trying to protect us, but at the end of the day, they tend to forget that American Muslims are American as well. And that's the piece that continues to baffle a lot of folks, is that even if you are American, you're going to be subjected to scrutiny. And we've been monitoring the situation at JFK for a really long time now, since the beginning of this year, where we're continuously getting calls from U.S. citizens who are Muslim, who are saying, I am traveling today to go to Egypt, or I'm traveling to go to Sudan or Libya or anywhere in the Middle East or North Africa, or even Africa, to, for that matter, Somalia. They're saying, please remember, here's my passport ID number, this is my name, I am a U.S. citizen. If my family does not hear from me, they will call you. And that's what we have been doing, is inquiring with CBP at times where we see that American citizens, as well as non-American citizens, are being detained longer than ever before.
And so how, just to a quick question to end this, because I want to jump back to something. I mean, how do you quantify that, though, that people are being held longer than before?
Historically, people would be held for secondary questioning, mm-hmm. be about 2-3 hours, and now it's like 6 to 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And the rationale there is we need to verify that this person is indeed mm-hmm. who they are when they are carrying a U.S. passport.
Okay.
So the wait times for people to get out of secondary screening has increased drastically across the board, and it includes even more people who are being detained for secondary questioning as well.
So let me jump back to Adam here, because one of the things that I did as a reporter covering DHS when a lot of these things started happening is I just went back and read the laws, right? And it seems like this is not really new policy, that a lot of this actually is within existing immigration law. I mean, things like, you know, the Border Search Authority and things like that, that those things have been around for years. So I go back again to what's new about this, because I think that, you know, the Obama administration, till around 2014, deported a lot of people, right? To the point where he was called a deporter in chief, right? So I just want to get back to what's new about this, because this seems like, you know, things I would tell my editor when people would say, well, you know, they're searching people's phones at the border. I'm like, well, they've always searched people's stuff at the border.
So I think you're right that at some level you could characterize this as just a continuation of prior practice, because it's true that in kind of two respects, you know, presidents and their administrations do have real tremendous authority over immigration policy, you know, kind of for two reasons. One is because the statutory authority and the constitutional rights of non-citizens who are seeking admission at the border are limited, contested, and that has created a large space within which the executive branch has long operated, right? Creating zones around the southern border where roving patrols can question people without suspicion, even though you're not actually at the border, leading the government to take the position that it is authorized to, you know, search without probable cause or reasonable suspicion or a warrant, you know, any device on you when you're at a port. So one thing is the sort of the perilous status of people's rights when they approach the border. And no, that's not just for non-citizens, that's for citizens too. The second thing is, as you said, you know, Obama is the deporter in chief. We have an immigration system that for a long time has left many, many, many non-citizens living in the United States without legal status, mm-hmm. right? It's a pretty arresting statistic. It's hard to make sense of immigration policy unless you realize that roughly 50% of all non-citizens residing in the United States are living here without legal authorization, something like 11 million out of the 22 million. And that also puts all of those folks in a kind of perilous legal status and gives the government tremendous power over them. And predictably, administration after administration has used that authority, both in the interior through deportation policy and at the border in screening and exclusion policies, to shape immigration policy to the administration's preferred views, kind of regardless of what Congress has been up to.
But that's all administrations have done that, right?
Exactly. That itself is not new.
So let me stop you there, because I need to just housekeeping here. So just want to remind folks that this is a Brennan Center for Justice program about extreme vetting and a Muslim ban at New York University Law School. We're talking to Adam Cox, David Beer, Lena Masri, and Murad Awadi. And I am Ron Nixon. I'm the moderator again. I'm a Homeland Security correspondent for the New York Times. And you can follow the Brennan Center on both Facebook and Twitter, and you can watch the programs on YouTube and listen to the podcast on iTunes. And all the reports and media are at their website at brennancenter.org, not .com, .org. All right. So let me jump into David with, so within this whole vetting system, right, that exists, you have your consular officials, right? Mm-hmm. Then you've got your DSS, the diplomatic security folks, right? You've got the ICE visa security system, right? You've got CBP that has a national tracking center, so whenever you book a ticket or whatever, that information comes up, right? They also have the these advisory programs in various countries where they have CBP people who are stationed to advise the airports, the airlines, whether or not to let a person on the plane based on stuff. You also have these preclearances, right? In addition to that, information sharing among a lot of the allies and stuff, right? That's pretty extreme, right? So how does this add to that? And from a national security perspective, can it be justified?
Well, no, it definitely cannot be justified. And when you talk about justification, you have to ask, what are we talking about? What would justify this intrusion into Americans' liberty to associate with people born in other countries? And that's really what's being impacted here. And every single person who comes from another country impacts the lives of everyone in the United States in some way. So there are consumers of American products. They're tourists who are spending money here. They're family members of U.S. citizens, and so on and so on and so on. So our liberties are being impacted by this travel ban, these restrictions on immigration, ultimately harm our liberty. But at a basic just economic analysis level, banning the number of people that the Trump administration is trying to ban is bad for the economy, which is bad for the people in the economy, which is all of us. And that's because people, travelers to the United States and immigrants contribute to the economy, either as workers by expanding economic output here or as consumers by purchasing and buying products here. So if we want to expand the power of the U.S., growing our economy is one of the best ways we can do that. And so limiting people arbitrarily from coming to the United States when they're not a threat is not something that benefits our country as a whole. It's something that's a loss to our country and a loss to our liberty as well.
So let me just ask this before I go to Lena Mara. You say arbitrarily, but they just did this entire review of going right to these countries and yep asking these countries for certain things, right? So is it really arbitrary?
So, yes, it is completely arbitrary. And I actually just completed a long review taking a look at how they came up with this list of eight countries. And they claim that the eight-country list is based on nine Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, criteria that every country in the entire world had to meet these nine criteria. What are these nine criteria? Well, one of them is that every country in the world has an electronic passport with a data chip in it. How many countries do not have that? 86 countries do not have that, and yet we have a ban that applies to eight countries, and three of which have an electronic passport with a data chip in it. And then when you see, okay, well, how do they apply this requirement to the travel ban countries to get them all on the list? Well, Somalia issues an electronic passport, but when the president applied the criteria to Somalia, he says Somalia failed that criteria, because not all countries in the world recognize this electronic data chip within the passport. Well, he just raised the bar for Somalia to make sure that they're on the list. He's not applying the DHS criteria to Somalia. And if you apply this higher criteria to every country in the world, rather than 86 countries, you're talking about 112 countries that don't have a passport that passes muster. So it makes it even more arbitrary. So ultimately, no, there's not an objective criteria. It's a ruse, and we should not believe that they went through this process.
Okay, but let me just play devil's advocate here. When you say they or the president, I mean, obviously you mean Department of Homeland Security and state, the ones who actually did a review, right? But this were primarily done by civil servants, right? These are people who've been there, law enforcement, intel people who looked at this and applied the criteria that they were given. But can it still be considered arbitrary if these people looked at it, you know, career, ICE, CBP, State Department, counterintelligence folks?
Well, we know how this ban came about. It came from the White House first. Then they shipped it over to the State Department, and the State Department said, we want nothing to do with this. So then they shifted it over to the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security does not have great, they're not the ones in contact with all of these countries' governments on a regular basis. That's the State Department. So right off the bat, you're shifting it to a department that's really not best suited for dealing with these types of situations. And so we don't know who came up with this list. The department, they claim that it's someone at the Department of Homeland Security, but that could be anyone, a political appointee, the hand-picked person of the president. So I don't believe that it was the career members of the civil service who have been here for decades who came up with this list. Okay. If they did, it would have already been in place long before President Trump.
Okay. So, Lena, you and both you and Murat have mentioned the fear from American Muslims about these products. But, so two questions on that. One, and either one of you guys can tackle if you like. Lena, like, take first stab at it. Like, how do you know someone is a Muslim? Like, you know, Keith Ellison, right? I mean, his name is Keith Ellison, a name that you would not associate with being, not to be stereotypical, but, or Andre Carson, right? So how is that even, you know, because a lot of Muslims, particularly, you know, African-American Muslims just have, like, a name like, you know, Timothy, whatever, right? You know, that. But even so, there are other nationalities, you know, people with different names. So how does that work, in other words?
It's interesting you bring up this question, because that is actually the defense that the government has insisted on throughout the lawsuit that I mentioned earlier regarding this particular issue of religious questioning. And what we did learn in that case, and it's important to understand that case because the policies and practices that we're exposing in that case are the same policies and practices that the Trump administration is using now to screen people for entry into the United States. But I took the deposition of a customs officer, and several other officers corroborated essentially what she said, is that on multiple times, she had attended a course. And there are FBI agents that also attend this course. There are multi-jurisdictional officers that also attend, ICE officers that attend. And the only religion, by the way, that is offered as a course to these agents is Islam. They don't take courses on any other religion. And the way this course is structured is the instructor literally walks into the room wearing traditional clothing, and you know, what he calls traditional Muslim clothing. He explains it to the agents in the room, and he teaches them on how to look at the clothing and determine, is this person a devout Muslim or a cultural Muslim? And I'm using their words, devout versus cultural. then the instructor would walk back out of the room, he would change his clothes, come back with a new outfit on, and have a discussion about that outfit. Then he brought different religious headscarves, different materials, and taught them the heavier the scarf is, the more likely the Muslim woman is going to be devout. The more sheer the scarf is, the more loosely wrapped the scarf is, the more likely they're cultural and not religious. He taught them how to read names, and just from the spelling of a name or the sound of a name, to be able to pick out the Muslim-sounding names. He taught them that in order to determine whether a man, a Muslim man, is devout, look and see what his wife is wearing, because a household tends to have the same ideology. And
so this was where? This was the Federal Law Enforcement Center? This is Quantico?
This is a training that is provided to CBP officers, FBI agents, ICE agents, multi-jurisdictional task force officers. So now you have the Trump administration coming in, okay? And within a few days of the Trump administration coming in, the CBP officers already are aware on how to question Muslims. How do you determine whether a Muslim is devout? They've been attending courses about this issue for years. And so when you talk to these officers, they're very attuned to Islamic concepts. They know what the different mosques are. They know who the different Islamic leaders are. And that if somebody mentions this person as opposed to that person, it means they might follow a particular sect as opposed to another. Mm-hmm. They know nuances. You would be very surprised.
So, the reason I keep asking the same question a different way is because, so, but where would this be? I mean, is this like the Federal Law Enforcement Center where these agents train, or is it Quantico where they train? I mean, is it this, and it's from what you're describing, it sounds like there's something that preceded the Trump administration, not something that the Trump administration started?
Yes, and these courses were described to us as having been given multiple times during the Bush administration, during the Obama administration.
And this was during a deposition?
Yes, they continue to be given right now, and they're given, they can't disclose the location, so there's only so much information that we can get. And a lot of the information is under seal in that case, but what we do know is that it is a repeated course that is provided, and there is no similar course for any other religious faith group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Rod, a variation on that question, you're an American. You're Muslim, but you're an American. You've got your passport. You've got everything. What's to worry about? I mean, you've got all your documentation, right? So why would you be stopped?
That's a great question. You should ask CBP and Border Patrol. I think that across the board, you see a lot of folks who are being stopped, including myself, for our appearance, right? I am married. My wife does not wear the hijab, but my mother does. And if we travel with my mom, that's additional scrutiny, not for my mother, who's disabled, but for myself, who's traveling with her. And you see that happen over and over again. And it's not only unique to my situation. It is, even when I travel alone, and if my beard gets darker, then that's a red flag, I guess. There's an association with having a beard and, you know, how devout you are. The longer the beard, the more devout you are. So I think that in these courses that Lena is referring to, it is referring back to the training in which these officers are given to profile people, pretty much. And the fact of the matter is, and you said something in the beginning of your question, that like a Keith Ellison, Andre Carson, they're both Muslim. 30% of American Muslims are African American. So this is happening to across the board with American Muslims, but more so when you have a Middle Eastern or Arabic sounding name. Okay. And those are very common. And if you go to a system that was apparently destroyed, the NCR system, you would have an amazing database there alone in itself where people were registering themselves for fear of deportation, which then led to a whole bunch of them being deported anyways.
So let me just one last thing before we start with live audience questions. You mentioned NSEERS before. You mentioned it. Would you tell the audience, people who don't know what NSEERS is, to explain what it is?
Blanking on the acronym right now.
Just tell them what it is.
Right. Pretty much after September 11th, the Bush administration created this system where men from Middle Eastern countries would go and register themselves with the newly formed Department of Homeland Security, and they would have to continuously go in and check in if they were an immigrant with any form of status. And that led to an enormous amount of Muslim men being deported, a lot from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, Astoria, and Queens, in the Bronx, in upstate New York, which has a huge amount of refugees, which we're excluding from this conversation. I kind of don't want to do that, sure. Who actually go through an enormous amount of vetting. And a lot of refugees aren't able to come into this country because they don't have proper documentation.
Sure.
And the ones who do and get through the vetting are now blocked from coming to the United States. And in New York State, where after manufacturing left upstate New York, it was, if not for the refugee community that resettled there, those communities economically would be devastated even more so than they were before.
Okay. So, now, Ron, I'm going to have to stop you there because we really want to get to it. And I'm sure somebody will raise that question so we can talk further about it. So we're going to take questions. There is a mic over here towards your right. My right, yeah, your left. So if you would come up to the mic and say your name and then address your question. And one question, please. I know you probably have a number of them, but just if you wouldn't mind just saying who you are and then address your question to the panelists. I know it's a great discussion. I know you guys probably want to hear more from the panelists and I'm short on time, but just wanted to make sure that we do get your questions in. Step on up to the mic, sir. It's free.
Hey, I'm Andrew. Do you guys have any data supporting like voluntary departures of American citizens because they no longer feel welcome in the country and like potential economic impact of really productive members of our society leaving?
Anybody want to say?
Well, it's not a direct answer to your question. We haven't kept data on that particular issue, but we have gotten a lot of calls, actually, from people that have contacted us and asked us whether they should voluntarily deport themselves and, you know, to avoid what might happen. But we haven't kept data. I'm not aware of any data either, but I think it's an important piece of information that we should be tracking.
Are you asking about American citizens, or I don't think that that's a great data piece if you're a law school student here to start collecting, but I don't know if there is a system of tracking that right now.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So my name is Ibrahim Kutabi. I'm a member of the Yemeni American community here in New York City. Mine is a more of a comment to what you guys said on the stage. And just want to shed some lights of the things that are actually happening in the Yemeni American community. The extreme vetting thing is more of, in my opinion, delaying and preventing families of U.S. citizens coming to the United States. I'll give you a quick example. My sister, who is a U.S. citizen born in Brooklyn, New York, got married to a Yemeni. We all originally from Yemen. In 2013, she applied for two of her kids. They were 5 and 6 years old. Since then, she hasn't gotten the visas for her kids. This is a U.S. citizen, and these people, kids don't need extreme vetting. All they need is a birth certificate and a passport to prove that they are who they are. And given that, the whole process for the 3 years, you petition with the I-130, that's applying for the family member. It takes over a year for the Yemeni national or people who, you know, related to Yemeni Americans, and then they approve the I-130 a year later, and then they send it to the visa center. It takes months to go to Yemen, and because of Yemen entered the security sort of hub for Al-Qaeda, and the U.S. Embassy in Yemen would take years to actually give you the interview, to call you for an interview. And if anything happens during that time, let's say your interview is on day, you know, March 13, if there is a threat, a security threat at the U.S. Embassy and you miss your appointment, you have to wait for a couple months to a year to actually, for your appointment to be rescheduled.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Sir?
I just want to finish the story of my sister, then you can ask me a question. So, going back to my sister's kids, and then the war broke in Yemen. They had to go to Djibouti to continue their immigration processes there. It took months. We didn't hear back from the Homeland Security, even after the petition was approved. They haven't sent it there. She went back to Bahrain where her husband lives. The U.S. Embassy, Visa Center, wouldn't send it to Bahrain. They said, we don't do visas for Yemenis there. Then we send it to Egypt. We asked them to go to Egypt. She waited couple months to get the interview. When she got the interview, they were asking her to provide documentation about the husband, who is not the petitioner, and not doing anything, and not applying to come to the U.S. So they asked evidence of connection to the husband, right? Not related, but we provided those evidence. Then after that, after things complete, they took the passport, they asked for DNA tests for the kids, which now we're going through that process, an additional $1,000. A few days ago, the DNA was confirmed that this her kids, which we already know. Now it's going to take additional months, and with the new ban, that can go to an effect.
Sir,
I'm just giving you a quick
example. Understood, but I wanted to let other people, and we're running out of time.
Fine.
The only question I have for you is that did this start under the Trump administration, or this continuation of the previous?
Here is the interesting thing. I think it got worse under Obama. Mm-hmm. It was hidden. No one is talking about it. Right. But Trump turned these kind of policies, trying to turn them into law based on discrimination, right? I think they were there. We were going through the whole process. I know people in Djibouti right now applied 15 years ago and are still waiting for their visas.
Okay.
I know people who, like the average Yemeni, would wait 3-4 years to bring their kids.
Okay, so
thank
you.
I can actually make a quick comment on that point. Sure. The Yemeni community in particular has been targeted by every administration since post 9/11, and it is a very unique country in this instance. Yemeni visas are the only visas in the entire world that are presumed fraudulent, and visa applicants are required to undergo DNA testing only in Yemen. And it is true that people that file for any type of immigration benefit that are Yemeni, a lot of times their applications can span, they can sit in indefinite processing, and they've been waiting for over a decade, and those applications will never be processed unless a lawsuit is filed in court to compel the processing. And this is something that we've done routinely for the Yemeni community because it is an unfortunate situation that's occurring, and it does get amplified. It gets worse now under the new ban that's in place.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Kita. Thank you for this amazing panel. I learned a lot. So I thought it was fascinating when you were saying, you know, the officers are actually taught, you know, if the longer the beard, the thicker the cloth, the more devout someone is, they're more prone to having terrorist tendencies or to being a terrorist. And I thought that was really interesting that the officers are actually learning these things. And even if they are American citizens, they're still getting hyper-checked based on their identity, their race. But my question is, in the wake of these Vegas attacks with people who don't even look Muslim or are Muslim and they are still, they are terrorists, right? What are the policies that do work, or if none of them work, are they supposed to be in these extreme vetting cases, or is change supposed to be made somewhere else? Like, how can we?
You mean like the shooter in Vegas? Like, what type of vetting is for that? Those kind of.
I mean,
people?
I'm just saying, like, if even if with immigration, if he ever left the country, came back, mm-hmm. He probably wouldn't have been targeted. And because there are certain restrictions and these vetting processes that do target kind of identity and race and religion. So I'm guessing, I'm asking what policies work, and if
anybody
policies
wanna...
don't work, are they supposed to be within the immigration law field?
Adam, David, Lena?
You know, I would just say that the risk of terrorism is so low, you know, and it shouldn't be seen as minimizing the tragedy when it happens. And, you know, it's a tragedy anytime there's, you know, a random act of violence. But these random acts of violence compose, as was mentioned earlier, 0.5% of all homicides in a 40-year period. And that includes the most, the biggest terrorist attack in the history of the world, which is almost certainly never going to happen again. So really, once you start designing policies for events that are so random that you really can't set predictors that are going to figure out that, well, this guy is a terrorist and this guy isn't. You know, the stuff about people being more religious means that they're more likely to commit terrorism, that's not true. No one said that so far here, I don't think, but it's not true. You read the stories about people who were Muslims who committed terrorism. There's no correlation there. You have some who are devout and some who, you know, are out drinking on the weekends. You know, it really, that you can't set a set of predictors for something that's such a low probability event as this. And so, is there ever going to be something that's going to prevent all terrorism? No. Can we do things that are obvious, keep out people who are joining ISIS? Yes, but we can't do things that are going to stop every terrorist attack.
So we have time for one more question from the audience, and then we will wrap up with a final round of questions for the panelists. So you're the lucky last question.
No pressure, you're going to make it good.
I think there's a fortune cookie that comes along with that. But, okay.
Thank you. It's okay, I can bend my knees. So I have one question for you. Do you think that communities that are already living in the U.S., are going to be under more scrutiny by immigration enforcement officers? The communities I'm speaking about are the ones that are, whose countries are included in this new ban. Let's say Chad nationals. Are they going to be under more scrutiny in the U.S. by immigration enforcement officers because of this ban? Because, you know, there's already this notion that they're not allowed into this country, and everyone that's working for the government knows this. So what is your perspective on that? And actually, I have another small question. Do you think that this time round, it's going to be, from a legal perspective, more chaotic than it was in February, let's say, at airports? Or do you think that now it's the administration has got more of things together?
Thank you. So let's did anyone want to take that particular question?
On the chaos point, no. What happened with the first ban is they tried to apply it to everyone from those countries, regardless of whether they already had permission to travel. So they figured out what we're going to do now is let the people who already have permission to travel come and go as they please and restrict it to new visa applicants. So really the ban occurs at the embassy door rather than at the airport in the United States. So we are out of sight, out of mind when it comes to the enforcement of the ban.
I was just going to say one thing on the enforcement point. I think you're right. It shouldn't be surprising if we see ramped up enforcement efforts against members of these communities who are just residing in the U.S. That's certainly what we've seen in the past, right? In the wake of 9/11, in the you know 72 hours or 1 week after 9/11, you know there were over 1,000 Muslim men who were arrested. And almost all of them, maybe all of them, were arrested just on status violations. And so it's frequently the case that the government uses, you know, just neutral enforcement measures to target particular communities, and that's made easier because our immigration law has so many people in violation of status.
Right. So I'm sorry, I have to wrap up. We're running out of time. I'm so sorry. So last round of questions from me to the panelists. Adam, there's some movement on from Supreme Court with the travel ban. There's still a portion of it that has yet to have any judicial review yet. But where is this going, in your estimate?
Well, it's hard to know because the recent developments do make it more likely that the case before the court is going to be mooted out. Right. So we're going to see new litigation. But I think kind of drawing back beyond some specific fight in some specific court right now, I think what we have seen recently by courts around the country is a recognition that this kind of popular myth that the government wields power over immigrants that isn't constrained by the Constitution is just that, a myth. Most of the historic examples that are invoked by government lawyers of all administrations, invoked by the Obama administration lawyers, invoked by Bush administration lawyers, invoked by Trump administration lawyers, where the government has adopted policies in the immigration space that discriminate against people on the basis of race and religion, like we have a history of such policies. In almost every case, those policies have been accepted by courts only in eras where we actually accepted open discrimination on those bases against American citizens as well. Mm-hmm. So it's true that the court accepted racial discrimination in immigration policy, but it accepted it in an era of Plessy v. Ferguson, when we accepted, de jure discrimination and segregation throughout the country.
Okay. So Dave, just in terms of this extreme vetting, the argument against it is that, well, we already have things in place and there's no need for it. But is there any way that this adds any extra layer of scrutiny, or is it what you described before?
It's what I described before, for sure. There's really just no benefit to these procedures, and the outright bans, cannot be justified. There's really no evidence of a problem here. I mean, if you look since 9/11, we've documented 35 individuals who came into the country since 9/11, who were then convicted of any kind of terrorism event, offense, or were killed in a terrorist attack and were foreign-born. And of those people, none of them would have been stopped from killing anybody in the United States. Only one of those 34 did kill anybody. That was the San Bernardino shooter. She was a Pakistani woman and a Saudi resident. Neither of those countries are in the ban. And it really just does not make sense to adopt this sort of blunt instrument when really you need to finely tune your vetting to target individuals who are actually, where there is actual evidence that they are trying to do us harm.
Okay. I'm told to close the program, but I do want to talk, Lena and Murad, to ask, going forward, if you can describe quickly, what are your organizations doing, or what do you anticipate your organization, if you could describe that quickly so we can close out the program.
So we're taking a two-pronged approach when it comes to litigation, and I can only talk about the legal department. And that is, one, we just filed a lawsuit along with the Brennan Center challenging the Muslim Ban 3.0. And the second would be to challenge the backdoor Muslim ban that I talked about as well.
Okay, all right.
To support organizations like CARE, Empower Change, and New York Immigration Coalition who are doing this kind of work and fighting on the front lines, in addition to, on October 18th, there is going to be a national mobilization to Washington, D.C. when the ban is supposed to take effect. There are buses leaving New York City. If you are interested, follow the New York Immigration Coalition's Twitter, Facebook. There are buses leaving from actually down the block from here. So if you're interested in that, it's going to be a national march and protest in Washington, D.C. with folks from across the nation coming together.
Okay. So listen, to close out, I just want to thank you guys for a great conversation. And I'm sure the audience, you guys got a lot out of it. I learned quite a bit, and we'll probably be following up with you guys to ask some more questions for my own work. But the Brennan Center also wanted to thank the New York Immigration Coalition for co-sponsoring this report that you have, the nice red report. Want to say thank you to guests Adam, David, Lena, Rod. Give them a hand, please. And Harsha. I'm not going to forget you, Harsha.